Okay, thank you so much. Okay, so we have a half hour. We have till 11 o'clock. What I'm speaking about, in keeping with the theme of parenting, is values, bridging the gap from moral knowledge to moral action. I'll start with a story. There's a guy, Robert Coles. He's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard, but He teaches three undergraduate courses, sequential courses, in values, in the psychology of morality. Very popular sequence of courses, and he tells the following story in a book he wrote on morality. There was a woman who was an undergraduate at Harvard, who was the first person in her town not only to go to Harvard, the first person in her town to go to college. It was a very, very impoverished town, a coal mining town in western Pennsylvania. And she got a partial scholarship to Harvard. When she went off to take the train to make her way gradually up to the Boston area, the whole town had a parade. They saw her off with the parade. And she took the three courses offered by Dr. Coles, and she did well. And he was very proud of her. He got to know her well, and he was shocked when, after she did well on the third course, she knocked on his door. She said, "Dr. Coles, I'm here to say goodbye to you. I'm leaving Harvard." He was shocked. He said, "But you're such an incredible student. I know your story. You told me about the parade. We're all so proud of you. You represent your town. You're the pride of your town." She said, "Let me tell you why I'm leaving Harvard." She said, "You know, I took the three courses with you." She says, "You post the grades. Everybody's ranked based on how well they did in your class." And she says, "You know who got the highest grade? Who was ranked number one in all three classes?" And he says, "Yeah," and he says the name. And it's the name of a very, very wealthy kid whose last name is on some of the buildings at Harvard. She says, "So he was ranked number one." She says, "You know that I don't have any money, and I had a partial scholarship, but I needed to work to put myself through school. And I cleaned apartments, either on or off campus. He had a magnificent apartment off campus, and I cleaned for him." She said, "Every single day when I'd go to his apartment, he'd go out of his way, together with all of his friends, to humiliate me. He'd have me do the most menial tasks. He basically made me feel like garbage." Then she gets up and she looks at Dr. Coles and she says, "Any institution that has such a disconnect between moral knowledge and moral action, I don't want to be a part of." Okay, so what I want to talk about in the next half hour is, how do you bridge that disconnect? I'm sure if I asked everybody here, what's morally correct? What is morally correct? Pretty much we know. We know. It's, you know, we spend a lot of years learning and we spend a lot of years living, and most of us are very knowledgeable about what the morally correct, ethically correct kind of behavior is. But what is it that happens when we're actually faced with ethical challenges? What happens in the street when we have self-interest involved? So I'm going to start with a couple of thoughts. I'm going to be talking about five main issues very briefly. But the first is based on some fascinating research, and actually a number of the ingredients I'm going to talk about, I don't know how many of you are compared with the research of Sam Olener. Sam Olener is a fascinating guy. Dr. Olener, who's a well-known sociologist and researcher, he was a kid during the Holocaust. And his entire family were murdered by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. And he found himself one day in desperation knocking on the door of a family in a farm not too far from where his parents were murdered. And they took him in. And they took him in for the duration of the war at the risk of their lives and the lives of their children. and they were incredibly kind to him. And after his liberation, he then spent the rest of his life researching what differentiated the people who took him in, the heroic, righteous Gentiles who took him in, from the other people in that area who did not take anybody in. So what differentiates somebody who's amazingly heroic and amazingly ethical from their neighbors who put self-interest, often understandably, in charge, right? You know, in front and center. So it's a fascinating question that Dr. Olinger asks, right? It's not a trivial question. And he did study after study after study, trying to explain what he owed his life to. And among the leading ingredients he found in what it takes to make a hero, what it makes to take somebody who acted the way these people acted with him, was clarity. Clarity and expectation. When he interviewed the heroes who saved people during the Holocaust, he found they grew up in homes where there was a constant explanation of rules. So it wasn't just rules that were dominating the life in those families. It was an emphasis instead on the values, the abstract principles behind the rules. So when you had parents who, when a kid messed up, would patiently and unemotionally explain, you know, this isn't really, I really expect better of you. This isn't the way we act. Here's what the rule is. Here's what we do. You know, we care about other people, even if they're of a different religion, even if we're surrounded by people who are teaching us and demonizing these people. But we know that empathy overrides everything. He found that when parents parented in a way that there was an ongoing dialogue about what the right thing was to do, that's what made all the difference. So that's number one, was the E of explanation. Parents who explained. Also, they showed how to do restitution. So if a kid messed up, when these kids were growing up, the kids who would grow up to be the heroes who saved the Jews, they explained to them in a very clear way, okay, if you did wrong, here's the way you have to make up. You have to apologize, you have to do restitution. Fascinating study done a few years ago. Really, I don't know how this study passed the ethical board of the researchers' institution, but this is what they do. They take four-year-old kids, and they videotape them with the following scenario. They have them go into a room where there's the psychologist researcher interviewing them, and the psychologist has on his desk a model car. And he tells this four-year-old kid, oh, you could play with it. I have to go outside for a few minutes. You could play with this car, but be very careful because this is my favorite toy growing up. But I trust you could play with it. But the car was rigged to break. Isn't that a horrible thing to do to a four-year-old kid? Okay? I'm not proud of this study, okay? So it's rigged to break. But here's what they look at. They look at how the kids handle their feelings and their emotions and their actions after they inevitably break the car. So some of the kids say, you know, well, it was a piece of junk, it's not my fault, and don't show much in the way of guilt. They don't try to fix it, they don't do anything. But then there's a subset of kids that are very upset, and they immediately try to fix it. When they see they can't fix it, they apologize to the psychologist, and they say, well, look, you know, let me just work on it, you know. And they literally try to figure out a way to make it up to the psychologist to do some kind of restitution. And then they follow those kids over the next number of years and find that the kids who make restitution, the kids who really try to fix it, the kids who own that responsibility for trying to fix the car, they are ethical and moral in a much more pervasive way in all of their interactions. Okay? The idea being that in terms of the take-home message there, is when kids are raised with a calm understanding, not a million rules, not a land of no's, but a land of saying, look, we're all connected. Here are the midos that we have to have. Here are the values. And you keep those values front and center, coupled with teaching kids how to make amends when they mess up in a firm but supportive way. Those are among the core ingredients that Dr. Olinor Fan was behind the righteous Gentiles who saved the Jews during the war. Tied to that is the second concept, which is the concept of ethical fading. The concept of ethical fading, which I think is a very important concept to know about, is something I've spoken about before to some of you. Ethical fading is research in the field of neuroethics, also at Harvard. And what they find in the field of neuroethics is that there's two sets of neurologic circuitry that take over, okay? So one is, if you're faced with a moral dilemma, like if I, you know, presented you with a moral dilemma right now, asking you what to do, okay? So I should tell you, you know, here's the moral dilemma. Almost everybody here would come up with a well-thought-out, maybe halakhically driven or maybe more philosophically driven set of issues of how we should act in such a case. We're hardwired to be able to understand what's the morally correct thing to do, especially products of our world. But then the same researchers who look at this find, okay, the part of the brain that lights up when we have a moral dilemma, it's when we get very upset about people who violate morality, and we hear about some of the scandals in our community, which make us all very embarrassed. But then they find the very same dilemma, when you're presented with it, okay? What takes place is the part of the brain that lights up because there's emotional kind of noise that gets in the system. And as soon as there's self-interest involved, soon as it's self-interest, I don't know, let's say you're on a job interview, and the person asks you, well, what's your salary in your current job? Okay? Or you're on the train, and you know that your kid is 10, and at age 10, they have to start paying full fare, or you want to get into Disney, or something. Okay? So when you get tempted to lie about their age to get into a movie at a lower price or onto the train or into Disney World or at a job interview about your salary, the default setting is that everything you know, where you know it's wrong, but that goes offline. And what happens during ethical fading, to just read to you what the researchers find, is we tend to see the trees rather than the forest, details rather than abstract principles. We tend to make quick decisions based on immediate feelings rather than calculated thought. Right away, we go all fuzzy. And the interesting thing about it is we almost never know that it's happening. We're often invisible to it. I see it all the time. People who are very ethical people, typically. And sometimes people who get very upset when they hear about dishonesty in our community. But then I see them, sometimes in the heat of the action, acting in a way that totally violates their principles, okay? And totally is not honest. And that's the challenge. The challenge is how to give voice to values. Now, the way those researchers at Harvard talk about dealing with this is they talk about giving voice to values. You have to practice it. You have to think about it. So if you're going to be going into a situation that you know you're going to be asked how old your kid is when you're taking the train ride into the city or when you're trying to get into Disney World, you have to think it out yourself. Maybe talk it out with somebody you trust ahead of time. Because when you think about it and you talk about it and you rehearse it, you're much more likely then to be able to act in a way that's consonant with your moral knowledge and bridge the gap between moral knowledge and moral action. All right, it's so little, a half hour, okay? Because I'm tempted to tell you a story, but I'm going to control myself. Okay? I'm going to control myself. Okay, let me move on. I'll see if I have, well, okay. Number two is, we just did the E of expectation. Let's do the E. How many of you know the story of Elish? The Gemara story of Elish? Let me tell you the story of Elish. I can't control myself. I'm sorry. Okay. Here goes. Elish is a figure in the Gemara And as part of the, I believe it was the Roman persecution, as part of the Roman persecution, he's imprisoned. And he's imprisoned with a non-Jewish prisoner. And it's known from other sources in the Gemara that Elish spoke fluent bird. He spoke the bird language. Whatever that means. Back in those days, people spoke bird. And one day, into his cell, a bird flies, a raven. And the raven says, "Elish, run for your life, run for your life." Now, Elish turns to his cellmate, who is not quite as good a bird linguist, but is still a bird linguist. And he says, "What did the raven say?" And the cellmate says, "Whoa, Elish, you know better than I do." He says, "Run for your life, run for your life." Elish doesn't believe the raven. Ravens are not a terribly trustworthy bird. Okay. Then a dove. Now, doves tell the truth. We all know that. Doves are truth tellers. So a dove flies into the prison. And he says, "Elish, run for your life." Again, Elish asks him, his cellmate, what did he say? He said, "Run for your life." Now, Elish sees, oh, there's a trend here. And he runs for his life and saves himself. So Rav Akiva Eiger asks, and then this is expanded on by Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, who has a brilliant essay on this, says, wait a second. Elish is the leading bird linguist in the world. We know that from other sources. Why does he have to turn to the lesser expert in his cell and ask him? Why didn't he just act on what he heard? So he says brilliantly, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, and I'll quote Simon and Garfunkel here. "A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest." I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember Simon. Two RJJ boys. That's what I'm allowed to do in front of the Aaron Kodesh, right? Two RJJ boys. "A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest." Okay? And that's so true. Whenever you're in a situation that you know that you're going to be morally challenged, and it's usually going to be a financial, financial, or very often we know when it is, we're going to get pressure to talk about things in a way that's not worthy of us, or to not be great models for our children, or to lie about something that's going on, it's extremely important to remember the lesson of Elish, which is ask other people. Give voice to values. So that's part one. Okay, part two, so that's the E of expectations and the E of ethical fading. Part two is the whole idea of eye contact. Eye contact and empathy. That's also what Dr. Olener found. We all know this, but I'll review it with you anyway. Eye contact is all important. It's so incredibly important because here's what the research shows. I've spoken in this room before about mirror neurons, right? So as I'm speaking and moving my hand, right, you know that there's a neuron in the motor cortex of my brain going like this. What the new research shows is as you look at me, you have a corresponding neuron in your brain going like this. We're hardwired for empathy. We're hardwired to care for the other person, but only through eye contact. In terms of Vayar B'Siv Losa, Moshe didn't even get the suffering of his fellow Jews in Egypt till he left the palace and saw it. You have to see it visually. All the research now is showing is that empathy levels of the younger generation has gone down as communication has shifted from eye to eye and heart to heart to this, to texting. And as it's shifted to looking down, it's a whole other kind of deal. So in terms of that part, let me tell you a quick corollary to this part in terms of what Dr. Olener found, and that's that when you're in a hurry and you're in a rush, it's hard to feel. In order to feel empathy, you have to pay attention. You have to not be a slave to this, okay? Princeton Theological Seminary at Princeton University did a fascinating study. They took a bunch of theology students, and they had them get ready to practice a sermon that they had to give that they were going to be evaluated on in a different building on the Princeton campus. But half of them were randomly assigned to give a sermon about a good Samaritan who helped somebody who was in distress that he found on a trip. Okay? So half of them were randomly assigned to think about helping somebody in distress. And the other half are randomly assigned to give a sermon on some other thing. They then have these students rush to the next building to practice their drusha. Okay? They then have waiting, again, psychologists could be a little sadistic, okay? Sadistic. They have lying on the road between the two buildings somebody who's like in distress, is acting like he or she's having a heart attack. Then they looked at, did these divinity students, did they practice what they preached? Did they stop to help out this person who really, you know, was in a life-threatening situation? Or did they ignore them? And they found the only predictor of whether or not they stopped to help that poor person who was feigning a heart attack was not what the speech was about. Okay? You could be giving a speech about the importance of helping somebody in distress and paying attention, or you could be giving a speech about something else. It didn't matter. You would not practice what you preach. The only predictor was how much of a hurry you're in. In order to care, in order to bring voice to values, in order to bridge the gap from knowledge to action, you need to be connected. You need to be paying attention. You need to not be in a rush. And one of my favorite quotes here is Rav Moshe Tzvi Weinberg from this neighborhood, you know, who's at YU and is a wonderful Rav here. He talks about the Avadatem Mehera, right? That the Baal Shem Tov said that the words we say a few times every day in Kriya Shema Avadatem Mehera could be understood to mean get rid of the rush in your life. If you don't get rid of the rush in your life, the E of empathy and the E of eye contact is going to be much harder to do. Next step. Next step is I try to force myself to get to the end is the step of expectation. This was huge in Olinor's finding. The kids who were raised in a way that they would grow up to be heroic, righteous Gentiles, one of the things that was clear in their childhood was their parents believed in them. Their parents believed that they'd bring out the best in them. Okay? That's what they really believed in. And that's all important. You know, and I'll tell you the, I know some of you have heard this from me before because I've been speaking about it lately. There's the story of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's grandson. Story in Bava Metzia that's fascinating. And what happens is Rabbi goes to the town where Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son lives. And we all know about the greatness of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his son. Many people go at Lag BaOmer to visit their kever. So Rabbi goes to visit the town where the son grew up in. And he said, well, by the way, I don't hear much about the grandson. What happened to the grandson of this great man, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, and the son of the great man? So they say, whoa, this guy was so out of control that the Zonos of the time, okay, were willing to pay like four times their going rate in order to be with him. They pay him, okay? Pretty decadent. So he took his handsomeness and he took his own beauty and his own charisma and totally threw it away to become famously decadent. So the Gemara goes on to ask, well, what happened to him? How did he turn out? And then the Gemara goes on to give a formula for bringing voice to values. And it's a fascinating formula that echoes exactly what I'm talking about here. You know what they did to him? They did three things to him. First, they gave him a mentor. They assigned to him his mother's brother to be his mentor. Then they had him move to a new neighborhood where he'd get a fresh start. But then they did something astounding. You want to know what they did to him? They gave him smicha. They gave him smicha. They took this decadent guy who was mired in immorality and depravity, and they gave him smicha. And Rav Moshe Feinstein asks, how could you give him smicha? He says, well, they probably put it away. You know, they probably didn't really give it to him, but they give him smicha. Okay? And the obvious take-home message here is they believed in him. They believed in him. They gave him a mentor who believed in him. They gave him a new neighborhood where people believed in him, given his lineage. And they gave him the degree to back himself. And they said he reached such levels of greatness that it was just assumed that he would be buried next to his father and grandfather in Meron. And there was divine intervention, and Abbas Kol came by and said, no, he can't be buried there. So people said, oh, it must be because of his past, you know, that I just told you about. They said, no. They said he was worthy. His tshuva was the true tshuva. He was totally worthy to be buried next to his father and grandfather, but he didn't suffer enough. His father and grandfather went through such tough times, he had life a little too easy. And that's why he wasn't buried next to them. But basically, the expectations gave him a totally fresh start. So that's the penultimate reason. And the final, and then I'll end with a story. The final point is about the E of emotion. The E of emotion is you have to care. You have to care. When you're emotional about a value, when it's something that I've shared with some people, that I went to a camp where I was a klutz. You know, I certainly wasn't winning any best athletes of the year award. And what I remember very vividly, coming home from camp every year, kind of embarrassed, because I'd get the loser award, which is called Best Midos. Okay, Best Midos. Okay? That's not, you know, and I knew it. I knew there. Nobody bragged about the Best Midos award, but what I remember vividly is the look of pure joy and pride in my mother and my father when I got. They said, look, you may not have gotten best athlete, you might not have been color war general, you might have been the world's biggest klutz in this sleepaway camp. They said, but we'll never be prouder of anything you do than getting a Best Midos award. You know, and it stuck. It stuck. That's the E of expectation, but more importantly, the E of emotion. What do you care about? What do you get emotional about? Let me end with a story, because I know we have to keep. It's not fair for me to go over, and it's in the last 2 minutes, and I have about a million stories running through my head. Now I'm going to do a little bit one. I'm going to control myself. I'll do a short one, not directly as related, but it'll make sense when you think about it. It's going to be tied to yesterday's laning. So yesterday we read about the Chatzotzros. So the Chatzotzros were, as you know, they were the trumpets that were used both when we camped and dug our stakes in. And for that, the symbol, the sound was a tekiah. That's what a tekiah means. A tekiah is when we drive the peg of the tent into the ground to get into a place of stability. Then, a trua, the sharp blast of a trua, was what was used in a time of war, in a time of taking up our roots and moving on. But as we know from Rosh Hashanah, after every trua, there's a tekiah again. Tekiah, trua, tekiah. And people like Rabbeinu Bachya talk about this in some ways. It's a metaphor for life. Life's about tekiah, trua, tekiah. Think about it in life. We have the tekiah. You may have been living here in Teaneck for a very long time. So you have the tekiah periods of life. And then, let's say you're a kid. You then have to go off and move to Israel and learn in Israel for a while. Or you may then go off to college. That's a trua period. But the key is, we then come back home, one way or another, the third tekiah in a new key. Kia, trua, tekiah. And that, in some ways, is the key to parenting, is to understand, is how do we envelop our kids with the five E's I talked about, okay? In a way that it could buffet them during the trua parts of life as well as the tekiah parts of life. Let me end with a story. Main area in my secular hat is trauma. Abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder. And so I have some colleagues in Israel who are very involved, and I've done a fair amount of work working with terror victims in Israel after terror attacks. But I regularly meet with my friends who are the terror therapists, the PTSD experts in Israel. So I'm speaking to a woman who is one of my favorite experts in the area, brilliant, brilliant therapist. And she told me the following story, and with this I'll truly end. said that there was a town, a Hasidish town, outside, just outside of Sderot. This is at the time that there was rocket fire constantly coming. And in this town, there was a six-year-old boy who every time he'd hear the code red, the Tzeva Adom, he'd go into fight or flight, and he'd go running all over the place. He was in a panic, and who could blame a six-year-old kid? He sees everybody around him is in a panic, and he'd go running all over town, all over the, you know, this little shchuna. His mother would go running after him. There were rockets flying all over the place, and it was life-threatening. So the mother took the kid in to see my friend, who was a superb therapist, but nothing was working. Absolutely nothing was working. The kid was in a panic, and it was literally life-threatening to two people. And then one day, the mother calls my friend and says, we don't have to come in anymore, everything's solved. My friend knew she didn't do it. But what the mother did, again, encapsulates exactly what I'm talking about. Encapsulates all five E's, okay? So the E of explanation, the E of ethical fading, of empathy and eye contact, of expectation, expecting the best, and emotion and emphasis. Listen to what she did. She goes to her little six-year-old kid. She says, you know, Elul time and Rosh Hashanah time, you know, we blow the shofar. She says, what's the sound? What's the meaning of a shofar? The meaning of a shofar is two meanings. One is, Uru Yishena Mishinaslam. Get up, wake up, you got to act. It's a time for action. Okay? It's time for action. And the second sign of the shofar, what's the second meaning of a shofar? Is you're not alone. Imo Onochi B'tzara, you're not alone. I'm with you. I'm enveloping you, God is saying, in my love. You're not alone. It was the meaning of the Chatzotro also. I'm with you in the times of Tekiya, the times of stability. I'm with you in the times of Trua, the times of instability. And ultimately, I promise you, there's going to be another Tekiya coming again. And something about this imagery of the kid now being helped by his mother to understand that it's a time for action when you hear the code red, but it's also a time that I'm not alone. My mother is going to protect me. God's going to protect me. That from that point on, anytime there was a code red in that community, a big smile would come across his face. He'd hold his mother's hand and calmly walk down to the shelter in time to be safe. So that's the bottom line message here. As we try to bring voice to values, as we try to bridge the gap, it's all about parents enveloping their kids with believing in them, making very clear what the proper values are, teaching empathy, and basically also showing what you care about and what you value. May we all be zoche to be able to continue to raise our children to totally internalize these values. Thank you, everybody.